It is 5 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
Voters select president and parliament in elections in Guinea-Bissau. Campaigning is ending ahead of Thursday's Algerian presidential election. I'm Victor Beatty reporting from Washington. Voters in Guinea-Bissau stood in long lines Sunday to pick a new president and parliament, the country's first ballot since a military coup 2 years ago. Here's reporter Anne Look in Dakar.
It's been almost 2 years since Guinea-Bissau tried to hold an election. In April 2012, a military coup disrupted that presidential poll as it headed to a runoff. Analysts say they expect it to go to a second round. There are several first-time or independent candidates. The two prominent political figures that were headed to the presidential runoff back in 2012 are not running this time. Both men were controversial when it came to the country's tumultuous political-military relations. Guinea-Bissau analyst Elizabeth Azevedo-Harman of London-based Chatham House.
It's really interesting that you come up for this election with the two main parties for the first time, with a different generation leading for the election. That makes the parties weaker. Yes, it's true that they don't have, you know, the charisma of previous candidates and that are well known by the population, but maybe it's a good sign for the need to have the short-term balance between the militaries and the politics.
Guinea-Bissau is one of Africa's smallest yet most unstable countries. There have been repeated coups, mutinies, and political assassinations since independence 40 years ago. No elected president has ever finished his mandate. And look, VOA News, Dakar.
The final campaign rallies were held Sunday in Algeria with incumbent President Abdelaziz Bouteflika, widely expected to win Thursday's election for a fourth consecutive term. The 77-year-old Mr. Bouteflika has been unable to campaign personally since suffering a minor stroke last year. His chief rival is former Prime Minister Ali Benflis. Algerians living in France have begun casting their ballots.
Voilà.
28-year-old Fatia said Mr. Bouteflika's candidacy shows he still has the capacity to rule our country. We will continue to trust him. But 44-year-old Kader said he opposes all those in power in Algeria and supports Mr. Benflis and does not believe the election has already been decided for the incumbent. With an estimated 140,000 Algerians in France, it's one of the largest Algerian communities outside the North African country. Paralympian Oscar Pistorius returns to the stand today for a fourth day of cross-examination. It represents the second week of the 27-year-old's testimony in defense against murder charges for model Reva Steenkamp's death in his Pretoria home more than a year ago. Here's VOA's Anita Powell on the first week of testimony.
Pistorius delivered the anticipated drama within seconds of taking the stand.
I would like to take this opportunity to apologize to Mrs. Steenkamp. I'd like to apologize and say that there's not a moment, and there hasn't been a moment since this tragedy happened, that I haven't thought about your family. I can't imagine the pain and the sorrow and the emptiness that I've caused you and your family.
Pistorius is charged with murdering his girlfriend, model Reva Steenkamp, at his Pretoria home last year. He says he mistook Steenkamp for an intruder and that he didn't think before firing 4 bullets through a locked bathroom door, killing her. But the prosecution argues that he meant to kill her and set up a blistering argument that attacked the athlete's story of that night and his claim that he constantly felt fear in crime-ridden South Africa. The trial has riveted South Africa, and it's the first major criminal trial to be broadcast live. Social media in South Africa has erupted with opinions on the trial, and the courtroom's public gallery is regularly packed. The trial continues Monday. Defense lawyer Barry Roux has said he will call between 14 and 17 witnesses. Judge Masipa will ultimately decide Pistorius' fate, which could be life in prison. Anita Powell, VOA News, Pretoria, South Africa.
At least 10 people reportedly died Sunday in heavy flooding in Tanzania's commercial capital, Dar es Salaam. The French press agency reports several roads and bridges have either been damaged or washed away. In athletics, former world 5,000-meter Kenyan champion Eliud Kipchoge won the Rotterdam Marathon Sunday at 2 hours 5 minutes. 29-year-old taking the world title in Paris in 2003 and the silver medal at the 2008 Beijing Olympics. Meanwhile, Ethiopia's Getu Feleke won the Vienna Marathon Sunday in 2 hours 5 minutes 41 seconds ahead of 2 Kenyans among more than 42,000 participants. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News. More can be found on the internet at voanews.com.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Monday, April 14th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. The trials of two of former Libyan dictator Muammar Gaddafi's sons is expected to start today, Monday, in Tripoli, but there are concerns.
It's a cause of real concern that a trial could get underway without the defendants having had their internationally guaranteed right to a lawyer respected.
Richard Decker is the director of the International Justice Program at Human Rights Watch. Commercial farmers want to return Zimbabwe to its glorious days as the breadbasket of Southern Africa. A South African village gets electricity for the first time, and South Sudan defends its rights to purchase weapons.
The government is entitled to protect and provide the security of the citizen and the integrity of the Republic of South Sudan.
Colonel Philip Agua, South Sudan's military spokesman, Somalia launches a fiber optic high speed in Mogadishu despite security challenges, and a tribute to an African-American singer for her role in the struggle against racial prejudice. Those stories plus Mark Oldman Sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. An official with the U.S.-based Human Rights Watch is expressing concern about the lack of access to lawyers for two of Muammar Gaddafi's sons and dozens of other former Gaddafi officials while in prison. This comes as the long-awaited trial of Saif al-Islam, his younger brother al-Sadi, and former Gaddafi intelligence chief Abdullah al-Sanusi, as well as dozens of other former Gaddafi officials, is expected to begin today, Monday, in Tripoli. They are all charged with war crimes allegedly committed during the 2011 uprising that toppled former dictator and Libyan president then Gaddafi. Richard Decker, director of the International Justice Program at Human Rights Watch, tells me that of concern also is the fragile security situation in Libya, which he notes poses a dangerous threat to defense lawyers and potential witnesses.
Access to an attorney in preparing a case is an essential fair trial right. And from the interviews we had with at least two of the accused, that is Saif al-Islam al-Qaddafi and Abdullah Sanusi, both of whom are sought by the International Criminal Court, they informed Human Rights Watch that they did not have access to a lawyer. So it's a cause of real concern that a trial could get underway without the defendants having had their internationally guaranteed right to a lawyer respected.
Then that raises the question of whether this government in Libya is capable to put these people on trial.
I think there are two aspects to that question. The first aspect having to do with the security situation, which, as anyone who follows Libya knows, is very tenuous and very dangerous. I mention that because it creates a situation of insecurity for all of the judicial personnel, the lawyers, the judges, etc., but in particular, it creates a potentially very dangerous situation for those defense lawyers and those witnesses who might be appearing on behalf of the defendants to give testimony on their behalf. The other aspect of the question is the government's willingness to afford the accused all of the fair trial rights that they are entitled to under international law.
Don't you think further complicating the whole process is the fact that Saif al-Islam is not in the custody of the government in Tripoli? We understand he's under the custody of some militia.
As you mentioned, Saif al-Islam al-Qaddafi is in the custody of a militia in the town of Zintan. Now, the militia states that it's operating under the control of the government in Tripoli. But the fact of the matter is, unfortunately, Saif al-Islam al-Qaddafi is not properly within government control. So the lack of custody over Saif al-Islam al-Qaddafi, I think, complicate the picture or prospect of fair trial to a great degree.
Richard Dicker is director of the International Justice Program at Human Rights Watch. He spoke with me from New York City. The spokesman for South Sudan's National Army says President Salva Kiir's government has no restrictions to purchase weapons from its international partners to protect lives and property as enshrined in the country's constitution. Colonel Philip Agua says the army will protect unarmed civilians in the country's conflict with anti-government forces. His comments came after rebels allied to former Vice President Riek Machar accused neighboring Egypt of providing military support to the government in Juba. But Agua tells reporter Peter Clotty that the government is committed to the peace talks as the army continues to protect civilians from rebel attacks.
First of all, South Sudan is a sovereign state. And the government of the Republic of South Sudan is capable of interacting with any political entity in the world, including Egypt. However, the procurement is the business of the government. So wherever they get the weapon, it should not be an accusation. It's a reality. The government of South Sudan is capable of getting weapons from anywhere. There's no restriction on the government of South Sudan where to buy and where to get weapons.
Well, some people have expressed concern that at this crucial moment when negotiations are being held to resolve the crisis, if South Sudan is seen as acquiring more weapons, then it is disinterested in the peace process. So what is your take on that?
It is the other way around. It is the government is entitled to protect and provide the security of the citizen and the integrity of the Republic of South Sudan. It is the rebel, when the rebel get weapons, this is where it should be questioned, because the rebels have no legal mandate to get weapons from elsewhere. However, we have not talked about the sources of weapons. We know they are dealing with some devils around the region, and that is not a big deal.
So which specific countries are you talking about where these rebels are acquiring weapons?
We will not go accusing anybody, because rebels can get from the black market. So whoever the devils they are cooperating with is not our big major concern.
Some people are saying that the government acquiring weapons, irrespective of where it's coming from, shows the government does not have a good will in negotiating at the peace talks to end this crisis. What do you say to that?
I think me, on behalf of the army, the duty and the constitutional responsibility of the army is to provide protection to the integrity of South Sudan, to the people and their property. So if we need weapon to do that constitutional mandate, then we do that while the government negotiates political settlement. We are sure the conflict is a political issue that was taken up very far by the politician. The politicians should have resolved their political problem away from violence. So meanwhile, we, the army, are protecting the people and the integrity of the country. The discussion and the dialogue should go on. They are not tied to one another.
Colonel Philip Agua is the spokesman for South Sudan's National Army. He spoke with reporter Peter Clotty from the capital, Juba. In Zimbabwe, the president of the Commercial Farmers Union says it is time for the government and the remaining commercial farmers in the country to bury the hatchet and start working towards improving the country's agricultural sector so that it can regain its past glory. Zimbabwe, once the breadbasket of Southern Africa, was reduced to a basket case after the government launched its land reform policy back in 2000 that removed commercial farmers from their farms. Charles Taff says now is the time for national dialogue on the way forward.
The time for emotional engagement has passed. What we need to do now is sit down as all stakeholders in a country and say, right, as Zimbabweans, let's fix this thing. We do not have to continue along this line. We just don't. And the status quo can be improved upon from this point. There's no finger pointing. Let's just fix it. Let's get this thing up and running and let's move forward. The agriculture sector here continues to underperform. It's performing way below its potential, and the reason for that is that the issues of property rights and security of investment have still not been resolved. So we still have a conflict, and we still have a country where the inherent value of the land is not able to be utilized, and so the banks aren't able to lend aggressively into that market. There's no structured funding. and the whole value chain basically of agriculture is not functioning. So we really are trying very hard with government at the moment to try and resolve these issues and get Zimbabwe to turn the corner.
Have you been trying to engage the government, like the Minister of Agriculture, for instance, to look at the things that need to be done that you have been raising, in particular to raise the production in the country so that Zimbabwe does not have to buy food?
Yes, we're in constant consultation with government. But, you know, what we're seeing is that the movement is not going quick enough. And we've got to break the cycle of dependence. What we have as a situation now is where, for this coming year now will be the 15th year, where we've got to import food again. And it just does not, in my view, make sense. The money that we are spending on food imports in a year could be utilized for many, many other things, such as infrastructure development, electricity generation, and so on. It's just crazy that we're going along this route. It's totally unnecessary. There's plenty of arable land in this country which is able to be utilized by everybody who wants to farm. But let's base it on an economic model rather than on a political model.
Charles Taff is president of the Commercial Farmers Union in Zimbabwe. He was speaking with Sandra Nyaira of VOA Zimbabwe program. It is Monday morning, April 14th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington, and please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time, 16 and a half minutes past the hour. South Africa is Africa's most advanced nation, yet an estimated 3 million of its citizens live without electricity. The government says it is working on improving its infrastructure so as to reach those residents, many of them in remote areas. But it is simultaneously struggling to provide enough power for its growing urban population. VOA's Anita Powell visited a remote South African village that is getting electricity for the first time in 2014.
Wilson Shitande has lived in the remote village of Kwakwane for as long as he can remember. He boasts that he knows every stick, every rock, and every plant in this settlement of less than 100 people. But one thing the 70-year-old never thought he would see has finally come to this village in South Africa's largely rural Limpopo province: electricity. In the local Venda language, the name Gwakwane literally means armpit. It's so named because it's wedged under the nearest river and other important landmarks. But perhaps residents say the village's modesty has also led to their being overlooked in their request for electricity.
We have been expecting that there would be electricity, but since we are poor, we have nothing. So we have just been hoping that someday something would happen.
Despite the villagers' appeals to the municipality, the power lines stop at the next village over. Local ward councillor Rabelani Garabeni says the power utility and municipality don't have the budget to bring the lines to Gwakwane. Instead, electricity is coming through a private initiative led by the University of Johannesburg.
We see that thing, it will take time so that we even happen to engage with the University of Johannesburg so that if maybe they can do a solar project, it will help our people faster than when we have to budget for the main line.
A team from the university's electrical engineering department recently traveled 800 kilometers to the village to install solar panels donated by a local business. Engineering lecturer M. Hove helped the university choose the village.
There are a number of these communities that are needy, but we found this village as the most needy. And as I often say, I call it the forgotten village.
The small amount of power generated by the solar panels will initially fuel a water pump that until now has run on diesel fuel. Hove says that is just the start of the project. The next phase will include more improvements. Godfrey Nafulupudwe has operated this aging pump for 4 years. He travels once a month to the nearest town to buy the diesel fuel. He says he's grateful for the small amount of electricity, but that he and his neighbors would like more. Gwakwane has always been a sleepy little village. But now that electricity is finally coming, maybe its residents, young and old, will get a better connection to the modern world. Anita Powell, VOA News, Gwakwane, South Africa.
Somalia has launched a fiber optic high speed in Mogadishu despite security challenges and opposition to the technology by the Al-Shabaab militant group. Experts say the service will hugely benefit the country's economy. Jama Mohammed is CEO of Dalkan Communications, the company behind the launch. He says that with the exception of Eritrea, Somalia is the last country in the East Africa region to get the connectivity.
We have launched the cable successfully November 23rd last year. and the system has gone for trial for a period of 3 months. The end of January 2014, the cable was successfully opened for public use, and right now it's pushing huge capacity for the public consumption in Mogadishu, the initial phase, and we have a plan to extend it to the rest of the country in the future.
So what's the level of usage in this new system in Mogadishu?
I can only confirm to you for the last 2 months, we pushed a very high capacity, which is actually transforming right now the lifestyle and the usage of internet in Mogadishu town. Most of the operators are already connected to the system, and they are right now subscribing the services. So huge capacity already, close to 1 gig is delivered to Mogadishu day one, and we are expecting more clients to come, and we will be connecting more.
How did it come so late to reach Mogadishu?
It's unfortunate that the cable was part of the initial design of a submarine cable in the east coast of Africa, and it's unfortunate that it came the last one that is connected in East Africa. That is contributed by the security concerns in Somalia, whether it be piracy, be it be the civil wars which are going on, and some political complications that arise on the licensing and delivery of the cable, particularly in the northern Somalia. All those things have been resolved right now, and the cable is terminated in the territorial of Somalia, and it is functional, delivering service to the public.
Yame Mohammed is CEO of Dalcom Communications. He spoke from Nairobi, Kenya, with Harun Maruf of VOA Somalia Service. The life of one of the most celebrated African-American singers of the 20th century is being remembered in Washington. This month marks the 75th anniversary of a groundbreaking concert by Marian Anderson. The performance transformed her into an important figure in the struggle against racial prejudice in the United States. VOA's Chris Simpkins has more on the world-renowned singer and some of the people she inspired.
These high school students in the U.S. Capitol headlined an event honoring African-American singer Marian Anderson, who overcame racial prejudice 75 years ago. With the help of President Franklin Roosevelt and his wife, Anderson was allowed to perform at an open-air concert here on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial in April 1939. Anderson's concert was organized after she was refused permission to sing in a nearby concert hall because she was black. Following a public outcry, 75,000 people instead attended a free concert at the Lincoln Memorial. Anderson was already well known in Europe in the 1930s, but this concert, broadcast around the United States, heightened her fame. Washington Performing Arts Society music director Stanley Thurston.
She opened the world to this idea of concert singing, and she also brought the history of the spiritual, the Negro spiritual, which before then had been sort of a community type song.
Genius, genius draws no color line. And so it is fitting that Marian Anderson should raise her voice in tribute to the noble Lincoln, whom mankind will ever honor.
Marian Anderson also became an important figure in the American Civil Rights Movement and for black artists who faced racial discrimination. Alice McClellan remembers the first time she saw Marian Anderson sing at the 1963 March on Washington.
Made you believe in equal rights. It made you speak out even when you wouldn't have. It made you raise your voice. Be aware for all people, not just blacks, for all people.
Anderson became the first black to perform at the Metropolitan Opera in New York in 1955. She also sang at Carnegie Hall, the White House, and at presidential inaugurations.
Land where my fathers died.
Now, decades later, these young people are learning about Anderson and the song she helped popularize.
And me sister riding his hand, he's got it.
Vocalist Anise Murillo says she's grateful for the opportunity to honor Anderson and follow in her footsteps.
She's also inspired me to sing my way. You don't have to fight with words or get angry.
These young artists say it's important to learn both about Anderson's music and how it helped bring change to the entire nation. Chris Simpkins, VOA News, Washington.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa. Sporting here is Mark Omar in Johannesburg, South Africa. Good Monday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa sports news, we focus on the South African Athletics Championships in the capital, Tshwane. African champion Simon Magakwe clinched his sixth consecutive 100-meter title in a national record of 9.98 seconds on Saturday. He hopes to retain his title at the Africa Championships in Marrakech, Morocco, in August.
It felt so great because, like, I was pushing the last 30 meters. Yeah, I was pushing so hard that I won those times. Everyone is happy because I ran under 10. That's what they wanted. You know what is exciting? My coach is from South Africa. He's not from America. It's not from Jamaica. So everything that we do it here in South Africa. So I think it's like amazing. You understand? Like, because, like, compared to other guys who goes to America, Jamaica, those kind of things, and then they break, it's not like their coaches come from South Africa. So I'm glad that my coach made it first. And it's something that's special, you know? Yeah. That means South Africa has a good coach. I'm looking forward for Morocco and Commonwealth.
That was South Africa's Simon Magakwe, the Africa 100-meter champion, speaking in the South African capital, Tshwane. Meanwhile, making a comeback after a year's layoff due to injury, Rikenet Steenkamp reclaimed her women's 100-meter hurdles title in a lifetime best of 13.17 seconds.
Well, after the heat, I knew I could, so then I expected it. But before that, I wanted to go lower than last week. Last week, I ran a 13.45, so my goal was 13.3.
Since your comeback after a year's layoff, you seem to be improving significantly. Have you set any goals for this year in terms of time?
Well, you know, I wanted to run this, so I'm just pleased now, but I want to go and run Commonwealth Games.
That was Rikenet Steenkamp, the South Africa women's 100-meter hurdles champion, speaking in Tshwane, South Africa. Staying in Tshwane, Wade Fanny Kirk retained his 400-meter title in a lifetime best of 44.92 seconds. He shares his experience through the race.
I was very motivated before the race. I motivated myself. I left everything in the Lord's hands. I asked him, Lord, please pull me through the race. And whatever you give me, I'll accept it. And I just went all out. The last 100 was tough, but that's when I said to myself, let's fight. And I tried fighting till the end. I had to die for the finish. Once for me.
That was Wade Fanny Kirk, the South Africa men's 400-meter champion, speaking in Tshwane, South Africa. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Omar in the South African capital, Tshwane. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. And briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Voters in Guinea-Bissau stood in lines on Sunday to pick a new president and parliament, the country's first election since a military coup 2 years ago disrupted a presidential race as it headed to a second round-off. That's it for this Monday, April 14th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for starting this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Mark Ullman, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Butte in Washington, hoping that you will have a very productive week.
Love African music.
Music time in Africa. Wake, 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 wake,
wake. Umaru, wake. This is Heather Maxwell, and if you do, Music Time in Africa is the perfect show for you. Tune in to listen on the radio Saturdays and Sundays at 0900 2000 and 2100 UTC. You can also listen to the show day or night on the internet. Go to voanews.com and voaafrica.com and click on Music Time in Africa. You'll find past and present radio shows and a link to my blog, African Music Treasures. This is Africa through its own music. Oldies, classics, traditional music, Afropop, and fusion. You get it all right here in one beautiful bundle on VOA's Music Time in Africa.